Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stuart Thompson. Welcome to Personal Transformation. It is September 14th, late in the summer, almost in the fall. Welcome to Personal Transformation. I'm broadcasting live from the Gatehouse at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard West in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And what can I say? I'm back. And, well, it's going to be quite an interesting conversation I'm going to have here tonight, because I'm going to be talking about belonging. And what I mean by belonging is, this may seem odd to some, but it's, or may not at all, but if you're coming from where I'm coming from and others that have gone through my same sort of experience, and I've heard this many, many, many times, is that, as a survivor of childhood of sexual abuse, one of the things, the biggest things that I've always had to deal with and physically, emotionally, all around, is having a sense of belonging. And again, what I mean by belonging is, well, do I belong here? Where's my home? Where do I hang my hat? That sense of belonging that I'm talking about is stemmed from a few different things. Well, one, probably because of my childhood sexual abuse, and two, from moving from home to home and not ever having a sense of belonging. So tonight I'm going to dive into that a little bit more deeper, and I would really, really appreciate anybody wanting to, if you want to contribute something on through social media, the means of Twitter, by all means, please do. I posted the link on my page, on the Blog Talk page. First, I need to get a couple of things out of the way. And one of the things is very, very important, and you all need to know this. I'm neither a psychologist or a therapist or anything of the sort. I'm only here offering my own experiences. I'm not here for anybody's therapeutical benefit or anything like that of the sort. I just offer my experiences in my healing journey to where I am today from when I came here 7 years ago. So if you are in need of help and you are triggered from some of the things that I'm going to say or I could say, then if you're in the greater Toronto area, then you can call the Gerstein Center at 416-999-5200. If you are downtown Toronto, you can call 416-408-4357. If you are in the Durham region, heading towards Ottawa, Cornwall, Belleville, Kingston, east on the 401 and down the King's Highway, dial 1-800-742-1890. And basically that number I'm giving you will work anywhere across Canada. And more importantly, I cannot forget our neighbors to the south, our American neighbors. And also this applies here in Canada as well. You can call RAIN, US or Canada, at 1-800-656-4674, HOPE. And if you want to go online, just go to rain.org, and they have a chat service on there as well. So, and they are 24/7. So there is support out there for you if you feel triggered in any way, especially by some of the things I'm going to be talking about tonight. So folks, again, welcome back. I'm really, really grateful to be here. I just had a lovely meal with a sushi meal with a couple other facilitators from the Gatehouse, and lots of stuff going on here. And I'm just waiting for this post. And let me see, do I got? Oh yes, good. Thank you, Maria. I'm broadcasting. I can't hear myself, but I'm broadcasting. And first, I must point something out too as well before I go any further into this as well. Earlier in the week, I was having a conversation with somebody on Twitter, that person being Flower Child, and which you always listen. And this particular person asked me to talk about this topic, which I'm going to be talking about tonight. And I've talked about this before on many, many different levels. So tonight I'm going to talk about it a little bit more in depth. And don't be shy to pass your comments down the line. And of course, through social media, of course. And I will talk about it, that's for sure. So don't be shy in any of your comments or questions or whatever the question whatever it may be, or your thoughts or your experiences. Please pass them my way. And again, welcome to the show. What am I forgetting? I'm probably forgetting something. Yes, I am. And this information is very, very important because it pertains to the Gatehouse. October 25th, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Healing the Voice Within, art exhibit and fundraiser. This is their second annual. Excuse me. Excuse me. And it will be held at the Spoke Club, 600 King Street, Toronto, at the Portland Room. I was there last year, and it's quite humbling being there, because there's lots of beautiful people I've met there, and there was some lots of beautiful artwork. It was just incredible. And in fact, if you were to go to our Gatehouse website, I believe, if I stand corrected if I'm wrong, but I believe there is pictures of that event from last year that are there, and you'll see all kinds of beautiful pieces of artwork. And it's also a great charity that you could be supporting, meaning the Gatehouse. And hold on one second here. Oh, yes. Hey, thank you, Flower Child, for joining in. And I'm going to get to you right in just one second, but thank you for joining in. I just want to get this announcement over with. Yeah, so this is our second annual. And if you would like to, donate or to come and check it out, then go to our website, or you can call our website, being www.thegatehouse.org, or you can call the Gatehouse at 416-255-5900. Speak with anyone of the volunteers or staff, and we'd be more than happy to help you out in regards to getting a ticket to this event. And we'd really appreciate your support, as this is what helps keep the house going. Little things like this, we're always doing things to help to keep going, to keep the house going. It costs a fair amount of money to keep the house going every year, and we're always looking for any funding to help us along the way. And this is just another great example of what our fundraising committee has done. And in fact, it's probably about a month ago, I had Mary Grogan in here actually talking about this. In fact, Mary will be back here in October as well to talk more about this and a little bit more about this. And actually, Mary also agreed that when she comes back, we are going to talk a little bit more in depth in regards to trauma in children in the schools at a much greater level. I'll be posting it well in advance in regards to when Mary is coming in again. But Mary will be coming in, and we will be talking about that at a much greater level than we were the last time that we came in here. And again, thank you for joining me. I'm going to run this by you again one more time before I leave tonight, or before I finish here this evening, and just remind you, and if you didn't get the web address as well. And one of the little announcements I'm going to make as well before I get going on with this topic tonight is that, what was I going to say? I can't believe I forgot what I was going to say. Okay, laugh. I'm laughing right now, but anyway, I had a point I was going to make, and I just sort of slipped down the trough and gone down the drain. It's gone, but I had a point I wanted to make, and I somehow lost it. But nevertheless, folks, welcome here tonight, and we are talking about belonging. Well, I guess you can talk about isolation as well, because it kind of slides in there as well. Isolation, dissociation, not having a sense of, feeling you belong someplace, and in the beginning of my conversation here this evening, I talked about my childhood sexual abuse had part of, I'm sure it was part of this, and also from moving from home to home. But one other real key factor I should really mention too as well is not really having, why I felt that was probably because I did not have a sense of being wanted by my own family. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. When you're passed around like that, it's very, very, thinking about it now and looking back, no wonder I was so messed up as a child. And I could see where it would mess other children as well. Okay, so right off the bat, Flower Child, thank you for coming in, and thank you for the suggestion on this topic we are having here tonight. So one of the comments that Flower Child is making right off the hop is survivors often have many broken attachments and find it difficult to settle down anywhere. And I really agree with that. And I look at how much I've moved over the years. Granted, in the last few years, I haven't done much moving, but I've done my fair share. And I'm going to share a couple of stories of my adventures of, well, I wouldn't really call them a great adventure, but adventures of having to move from place to place. And one of my previous experiences of doing so, where I really felt I didn't belong, I was living at a place. And okay, now folks, you know what, here I'm gonna be so vulnerable, I've never really talked about this before, and I'm going to be right out and open and talk about this. And I know I'm going to have people that can relate to me completely about this. Is what I'm going to say is that what happened to me was, what I did was, well, I was living in a place, and I knew it was only temporary to begin with, and something happened. I won't get into all the details in regards to that. So what I did was I left, and then when I left, I did, not even having a place to go and live. So what I choose to do, this is probably within my fourth year of coming to the Gatehouse. So what I did was I left the place I was living at, and I got into my vehicle, and I basically lived in my vehicle for probably 2.5 years. And let me tell you a little bit more in depth of why I have, well, my reasoning behind all that, and a lot more. Well, anyway, I have more to say about to why I did that and what I thought and what I believed. And don't get me wrong when I say that now I look at it and say, okay, well, I see that was really, really wrong. But all I could say is you would have had to have been in my headspace at the time to understand what I was thinking and feeling to what drove me to do that. To me, that was no different than when I used to live on the streets. Because there's a form, there's safety there for me. And that's what it was safety for me. And then there's a bunch of other things on top of that. But the biggest thing I would say was by doing so, right or wrong, it to me is irrelevant. Anyway, right or wrong, I chose to live like that. Don't be wrong, I was always able to, I always had clean clothes. I always had a place to have a shower. The only difference was it was just another big secret, a huge, huge secret, which I can't say that I'm very proud of. And I would think, judging from what I've heard from other people who have heard of people living like that, that's really, really sad. And most people don't really understand it and get it. And the people I heard, well, obviously people are judging, obviously are going to have some pretty harsh remarks and pretty harsh criticism to why a person could be living like that. When really in retrospect, well, I'm making money and I really have no reason to be like that. Well, let me dive a little bit deeper into why I chose to do that. And again, it's all related to what happened to me as a child. And although I see it now as being all pure BS now, but, and that was my logic and that's what I was thinking, that worked for me at that time. And, you know, one of the big things I was struggling with very, 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 very much so was, well, again, trigger moment here, warning, I was contemplating suicide. I've always thought about that. But more in depth, and I had a plan, I had everything. Again, I apologize, this sounds really, really hard, but this is the actual truth of it. And then for most people to understand this, well, I can't say that honestly most people would understand this or would even want to understand this. Considering the circumstances, I could have done many other things where I didn't have to live like that. But you got to try to understand that money and all that sort of stuff really meant nothing to me. And, you know, having the so-called status of having an address and all that stuff was really, really, truly didn't mean anything to me. You know, it really didn't, because I really didn't feel I belonged. And I incorporated suicide into that as well. And that was all part of my so-called package, what was going on in my head. So I needed to figure that out. I needed to figure out that, okay, well, do I want to live like, keep living like this? I'm not sleeping much, eating poorly. I was always showered and bathed, and I always had clean clothes. That's easy enough to do. Thank God for places you can go, like hotels and coin washers. That takes care of all that. And be honest with you, nobody would ever know any different other than if I had told you that I was homeless. But you got to try to understand, like I say, that was by my choice. It's not that I couldn't afford it or I didn't. I just didn't want it. And I'll tell you again a little bit more in depth why I didn't want to do that is because, again, it falls back to that sense of belonging. But I, for the longest time, for many years, even when I first started coming here, when I first came here, life was minute by minute. And then life became hour by hour. And then as I progressed in my healing process through here by coming here, it extended from minute by minute to an hour by hour to day by day to a couple of days at a time to a week by week and so on and so on and so on. And that was my way of coping with what I was coping with at the time. And that was my way of saying, well, you know, the hell with everybody, and meaning, well, people, upper people, you know, people above myself. That was my way of saying, the hell with you. I'm going to do whatever I want, and I won't be told what I had to do. I could still drive my driver's license. I had a place with my driver's license, so I could say, well, I have a driver's license, for example. Even that, I had to be think about that at the same time as well. So I had no driver's license. I didn't have a address. I took care of that as well. So at least I had a driver's license, and I was able to go around, and I wasn't stuck in one place. So that gave me complete freedom of where I wanted to sleep, what I wanted to do, all those sort of things. But nevertheless, and that's what I did to myself. And again, I'm not really looking for blessings for people, so whether they agree with me or disagree with me. I already know what people are like already, and people judge you right or wrong. But that's really not what this is about. I'm talking about this because I want you to be aware out there that, well, if you have gone through this experience like I have, like I'm talking about, then you'll know that you're not alone. And with my perseverance of wanting to change that, which I did, because a lot of, you know, as much as I'm telling you what I did and how I dealt with it for all that time, really deep down, I didn't want to do that. But my alter ego, or my other side, my conscious, call it whatever you want, would always tell me, Stu, you know what? You don't want to be here. Let me rephrase that. I want to be here, but I'm not sure. That was what I was thinking. Two more points from Flower Child. In our crazy society, it is even seen as shameful to be a transient. Absolutely. When we abuse, and the second comment, when abuse is the reason why we cannot attach to a place and make our home for ourselves. And that's all with what I'm saying. And Flower Child, thank you for saying that. You're just saying it better than what I'm thinking it, but that's really the truth of it. And you know, struggling with that was very, very, very hard. And I think that one of the things that's probably given me the courage to do so, to even speak about it to the level that I have now, is that, well, for one thing, our founder of the Gatehouse, for example, he's often made reference to this story, which is very similar to mine. And obviously our stories were a little bit different, but my point being that he lived out of his vehicle before he did anything to try to change his situation. And unlike myself, he helped himself, and he, you know, which brought him to what the Gatehouse is now today. But that was a great example for me to really, you know, at least I felt that somebody understood me. As when I told Art the story, I hadn't told anybody the story. And now when I think about it, it's pretty heart-wrenching in my own way. I'm going to try to be a little respectful of my language here, but it's actually harder for me to speak about than I really realize now when I'm talking about it. But nevertheless, it needs to be spoken, because you all out there who might be listening and might be going through the same experience need to understand that you can get past that. I still struggle. No doubt, I'd be lying to say that I don't struggle with that sense of belonging. But the only difference is now that when I talked about in the beginning, where I talked about time, for example, where I wasn't sure whether I was going to be around, that's changed. And the more I talked with other people, and the more I dealt with what I was thinking, then my thought patterns changed. And probably one of the biggest things that changed with me is my belief towards myself. And don't get me wrong, I'm not riding fly on a magic carpet here where I'm thinking that it's all good and beautiful. Well, in retrospect, I think a lot of things are, but I guess you can call this being stuck, or a stuck moment, or you know, just reliving the past. Well, you know, as I've stated in the past before, that sometimes these things that get attached to you just take a little bit longer to work on, to try to change. It is possible. you know, to get that stuckness out and to change those thoughts, as I have in regards to my description of how I lived for that time. And, you know, and the frustrating part about it is I didn't even have to live like that. And yet I chose to, because I really didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be, well, I don't, I guess probably because I, what's, I guess a good way to say it, probably because I don't want, I want the attention, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I've always done a very good job of keeping things to myself. And I was, and that's a great, this is a great example of one of the things that I've kept to myself for all these years and really have not disclosed to anybody. And here I am disclosing it to you. So I think it's important that I do talk about this, because I've come across this far too many times where I hear people feel they don't belong. And I can ever so greatly relate to that when I hear that comment from people, you know, whether not just from other survivors, but from people in general. And, you know, and I often think when I've heard that person say that and say, oh my gosh, you know, not only can I relate, but can I tell you a thing or two? But I never did that. And I chose to keep it to myself. It's just another one of those dirty secrets. I what I call a dirty secret, which I choose to keep to myself. And, but now I realize after this much time and through my healing process that I can't keep this quiet anymore. It needs to be said, because other people, I've met other people that have done this as well, not just Art, who I just pointed out, and which he's been quite open about it, but myself as well. I mean, it does carry tremendous shame in a lot of ways. And some ways it also, you know, even, you know, can even bring up a little bit of anger at the same time. Like, why the hell would I do that to myself? Really, why would I do that to myself? And to me, well, that was just another form of self-sabotage. And that, trust me, I think of all the accomplishments that I've done over the years, I swear I graduated with honors in self-sabotage. Granted, these last years, not so much, but years prior to that, I got honors easily for self-sabotage. And that was just another one of my train rides that I did that allowed me to do that. And nobody knew about it. You know, this is the horrible thing about secrecy, is that, you know, you hold on to this for a long, long time. And, you know, and depending on the individual, it'll eat away at you from the inside and cause, you know, who knows what it'll cause. But in a lot of ways, it's kind of nice to get this off my chest. And I haven't really, really discussed it a lot. But what does belonging mean to you? I would ask you, how does it, you know, when did you get that feeling you belong someplace? Was it when you were a child? When you first got married to somebody that you really, really cared about and they made you feel like you belonged? Was it a club you joined? You know, whether it be a 4-H club or, you know, Cubs or Brownies or, you know, the Kinsman Club, for heaven's sakes, like a church, even depending on what you believe in, you know, and actually felt like you belonged someplace, you know. Coming to the Gatehouse just gave me that sort of sense that I belong. I had a sense of belonging, and it took me a long time to realize that. But when I did realize it, it's like, wow, right? You know, when you've gone through all your life and you think that really nobody gives a damn, and you know, you don't give a damn yourself. So why would you even fathom the thought of moving forward and bettering yourself in any ways, even as something simple as having a place to hang your hat? Who the hell really cares? Those are the kind of thoughts I was thinking. So it was very easy to self-sabotage myself and to fall back into that hole. Flower Child, survivors can be afraid to make a home for themselves in case it's destroyed like it was in childhood. And again, that's another point I can, a Flower Child that I can really relate to at the same time as well. When you go from home to home, especially when you've been sexually abused, you, as a child, you will never have that sense of belonging. All you, what I remember from going from home to home is knowing that I never really had a home. And even then, when I finally, whenever I did get that feeling or that sense of having a home, I would end up losing it anyway. So therefore, when I talk about all I know, well, that's all I knew. So that is so important. That was so important for me to discover and to figure that out. Now, you out there, all granted, your experiences are going to be totally different than mine, but I'm telling you, it's definitely worthwhile seeking into, looking, and seeing that, well, it's worth it. You're worth it. It took me a long time to figure out that I was worth it, and even to this day, I'm still have to remind myself that, yeah, you're worth it. And I don't know, it's just a very, very, you know, the more I think about it, the more I talk about it, it's very, well, it carries a lot of shame, as I pointed out. And all I know is that I would do anything to change that. And basically, that's what I've been doing. So, you know, one thing I did not mention in this whole 50 minutes or 20 minutes that I've been talking, or actually almost a half hour, is I never brought up the word trust. You know, I talked about how I self-sabotaged myself and how I lived out of my own vehicle, how I lived on the streets. But what about trust? I never talked about trust. Well, in that whole thing, trust was one of the big things, if not for you, for me, which I had none. So if I don't trust anybody, then why would I believe anybody? So therefore, I believe that, okay, well, if I don't trust you or I don't trust anybody, then I'm better off just be by myself. You won't be able to find me. I can find you, but you can't find me. And that's what worked really, really well for me. So, you know, I'm just going to read this out to you. Now, in regards to secrecy and child abuse, in the instance of child abuse, keeping a secret is absolutely necessary for the perpetrator in order to avoid the consequences to allow continued availability of the victim. The longer the secret is held, the longer the behavior is able to continue. The offender usually knows that this is conduct and is against the law and is therefore not averse to telling the child bad things that will happen to them if the secret gets out. Many wonder why children do not tell. This is a threat aspect is one of the reasons. Children will usually keep the secret unless the confession and the pain is too great, or unless it is accidentally revealed. Many never tell or do not disclose the secret until years later. To some, the experience is so shameful and traumatic that they actually forget or block the experiences. The other problems arise in adulthood. Therapists often find to surprise the victim that the child abuse, which was blocked, is the root of the present problems. Okay, well, what I just read out to you kind of falls in line with what I'm talking about. You know, especially when I talked about the shame, for example. You know, even when I lived on the streets, and that's probably a better example of when I lived on the streets, I was living with this and no one to talk to. And even if I did run into some, and actually just no one to talk to, and it was just, you know, it was just really, really, well, there was no one to talk to. And therefore, it was very easy to, well, again, I'm going to call it self-sabotage. That's another great example of, well, I chose to go to the streets because, well, not that I didn't want responsibility. And I want people to understand this. It's not that I didn't want responsibility. I've had lots of responsibility and carried it out right to the end. What I'm talking about is responsible for my own well-being and caring about myself. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, all that other stuff at that time that I was feeling like that was really irrelevant and had really no bar on, you know, what I felt or what I was feeling or, you know, whether you gave a damn or whether I gave a damn. None of that even came into the picture. So it falls back to isolation. It is critical to develop and understand of a difference between keeping secrets and asking someone in confidence to hold and to honor your experience. Added to this is a complicated layer of honoring disclosure of one's own story and one's own pace. It is critical that each person feels that they are being allowed to come out of hiding in their own pace. The purpose is not to make people reveal their story, but rather to explore the difference between what we're told as children and our present day need for community and personal connection in order to heal. Well, you know, that's something that kind of fell along with what I was going through. And, you know, again, it was great for me to be on the street, great for me to, you know, when I was living out of my vehicle for that time. You know how much I kept to myself? I spent a lot of time to myself. I would work during the day, and it was wonderful, because when I was done, then I didn't have to talk to anybody. So it was great. I could go to work. You know, work is always different anyway, because it's you're only talking about work. You're not talking about anything. So it's just strictly on a professional level. So it was very easy to go to work, do my thing, make money, and then just go and isolate myself. And isolate my, you know, I had my secret there. Granted, the last time I did this, I was at the gatehouse. So I was coming into the gatehouse, and I was working on my problems, but isolation was still one of those things that I was holding on to. You know, I would come here. I only had the one. To me, coming here was great because then I could talk about that stuff. But when I left here, it was a different story. And me being a stubborn male that I am, and middle-aged male that I am, never would really talk to anybody to begin with. Even when I left the gatehouse, I would never, you know, I had people I could have called, you know, I could have talked to if I felt that way, but I never did, you know. And I only just ever disclosed that I was living, not living, or living out of my vehicle, you know, to one person while I was doing it. And that person kept my secret for me. You know, which I'm really, really grateful that the person did, but at the same time, it's all of my own doings, and if anything had ever happened or anything, it would have been my own responsibility, as it has been all the way through. Well, one of the great things at the gatehouse, we believe that no one should suffer in silence. Many adults have suffered in silence about their childhood sexual experiences before they found the gatehouse. Silence in isolation is a perpetrator's imposed crime meant to undermine the child's anatomy. It constitutes, in our society, as one of the most heinous crimes against child's personal development and social safety. The group experiences, like we have here at the Gatehouse, addresses the community responsibility we hold together to reach out for those who have been silenced and isolated by their own experiences of childhood sexual abuse. Now, the stuff I'm talking about is all kind of related to what I'm talking about. I threw trust in here. I talked about isolation, and I've talked about secrecy. I've talked about shame, and, you know, just the plain fact of self-sabotage. You know, all those little pieces really, really, really can hinder your life in a lot of ways if you're holding on to those things. You know, I talked about stuckness. Well, hell, I had stuckness for the longest time. It's taken me a long, long time to let a lot of that stuff go, to be where I am now, to even talk to you on the level that I am. Even 2 years ago, for heaven's sakes, when I started doing this. And this show has been a great, great help for me, you know, for my voice and helping me to move forward in many ways. Because, for example, like what I'm talking about tonight, I can't say I never would have talked about it in the open, and I probably would have. And in fact, I'm at that spot now where I probably would have given the opportunity to others, giving others, you know, that, well, hope for one thing, and also knowing that they're not alone if they've been through the same experience. Another comment from Flower Child. The hyperarousal survivors feel in their bodies means that being close to people feels uncomfortable and agitating. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And another point you're making is this: hypertension is beyond our control and does heal in various therapies. Yes, it does. again, thank you for your comments, Fire Child. So let's go back to trust. When moving out of isolation, trust building is a crucial first step. This is an essential element for maintaining confidentiality as opposed to keeping secrets hidden, like we did the secret of childhood sexual abuse, me living out of my bloody truck. Peer sharing, for example, like we do here at the Gay House, growth from isolation, which has impeded our ability to move forward to conclusion, which makes powerful new choices available. So what I'm saying basically is that in trust building, what I had to do for myself, and I've seen many others do the same thing, is that by coming in here to the Gay House and sitting in with a group of men or with a group of men and women, been through very, very similar experiences as myself. Obviously, you know, we're not going to be identical, but you know what I'm saying logistically anyway, that our experiences are very close and similar. So therefore, our behaviors, whether it be ill-mannered or not ill-mannered, will be very similar as well, whether it be through addictions, as an example, or isolation, dissociation. You know, those are just some things that you could, well, you, I, anybody could have been through these experiences in dealing with this, in coping when I was coping with my stuckness and my self-sabotage, that's how I would do it. So finding a better way as I have, such as doing my radio program, for example, and just public speaking, being very open about speaking about this, to me, has been one of the biggest healing factors of my journey. Now, I'm talking about this only for the very first time on live radio, and the whole world has heard me now, so I can't very well deny it or anything of the sort, but that's what I did. And whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, again, like I say, that's irrelevant. That's where my head was, and that's what I was thinking at the time. Yes, you know, I carry shame for it. I felt guilty for it, but hell, I did it anyway. Because, well, my secrets were safe with me. I didn't trust anybody. If I did trust anybody, it was only very few, and they were only here at the house to begin with. So my branch of people outside the gatehouse was pretty much nil or none. So I would do other things. I would socialize with other people to a certain degree, but nobody knew. Nobody knew. And, you know, it's I'm still amazed that I'm actually talking about it now. The fact that I was able to get through it, and I didn't go through what I was thinking about. Survivors cannot relax around people, and it's not our fault. Somatic therapies have really helped me, and this is Fire Child. And yeah, thanks for sharing that. So anybody out there listening, you might want to consider somatic therapies as an alternative source of treatment for yourself. And again, as I always say, do your research first. And don't get into something or get involved with somebody you realize after the fact it was not a good idea for you. So do your research first and find somebody that's actually going to help you in the way you're looking for, suiting your needs. So please keep that in mind as well when doing so. Where am I? Jeez. Okay. So I would ask you out there, well, I kind of asked myself, and I've kind of been saying it anyway, so I will ask you the same question I've asked myself and kind of, and I've been talking about. So I would ask you, what are some of the reasons why you kept your abuse a secret? You know, like, can you think of some reasons why you would keep your abuse secret? Well, I know mine, for example, I had a lot of reasons why. Well, one, because of the shame, and I'm not trusting anybody, you know, not wanting anybody to find out really, really who I am or what I'm about. You know, never let anybody coming to the, you know, I'll let people come to my front door, but I don't even let them in. You come to my door and talk to me, but it doesn't mean I'm going to let you in. you know? So I ask you, what are some of the reasons you kept the abuse a secret? Well, I gave you some reasons for myself. And more importantly, keeping those secrets, how did it make you feel? Did it drive you crazy? Did it make you want to go out and get drunk? Did it make you want to go out and use drugs? Did it make you want to go, I don't know, whatever your addiction might have been? You know, I'd eat ice cream. It could have been anything. You know, I gave you some really, really extreme examples of, well, self-sabotage, you know, and I'm talking from lived experience. So I relate to myself, and this is what I'm talking about really, really well. Those are really good questions. And I know that when I had those questions asked to me, I really struggled with them really, really, really hard. I don't want people to know what happened to me. I'm afraid that I was going to get shamed all over. It's not a man thing to do to talk about this sort of stuff. You know, and if I did talk about it amongst my peers, especially men, they would look up down upon me. They would see me, deem me as being weak and not being strong to do whatever task that may be at hand. All those old stigmas of, you know, caveman stuff from 100 years ago. You know, I know I'm exaggerating my caveman 100 stuff years ago, but you know what I'm trying to say. Old beliefs that are really outdated, washed up, worn out, and just pure BS. Well, that's my opinion anyway. We are in a new millennium. And granted, we're barely the first 20 years in the first millennium. Having a supportive friend to go with you to buy things for a home is very helpful. Yes, thank you, Flower Child. You know, I know in my experience, when I got my first place, I never had that kind of help, but that's a really good idea. And especially with somebody you trust. Many men and women who were sexually victimized as children often find themselves faced with perplexing challenges as an adult. The skills they use as a child tend to be counterproductive as an adult. The perils of silence became more painful than the risk of transforming and healing. Outlining the stages of recovery can be a misleading message to someone who's looking for a sympathetic, definitive plan that specifically tells them, you know, what their journey will entail. Every individual's recovery process is unique. No two are identical. However, most journeys have commonalities, as I pointed out. I'm going to read the 10 stages of recovery to you, which we have here at the house, and which I am hoping that will be very, very helpful for you in the process of having a sense of belonging. And I know that my process has been through here has been, well, it's been monumental in my personal opinion in regards to what I was and who I am now. So I'm going to share that with you. And as we do, share them with the participants at the Gatehouse. Each person has a different web of followers and a different path. People can be in various stages or dealing with several of them at the same time that I'm going to be reading out to you. A person can be at one stage in an aspect, their lives, and at a completely different stage in other areas. So what I'm going to read to you in these 10 stages does not necessarily mean that you are all or even one of these, but you could have little bits and pieces of all of them or even a couple or even one of them. And I'm not saying that you will. I'm just saying you could. The stages outlined, which I'm going to read to you, can help you design your own plan based on the experience. This is all based on the experience of others. The model personalizes the journey of most, but not all men and women. This is a brief summary of the topics we'll expand, which I always expand upon here on Personal Transformation, and we do here at the Gatehouse. So, Anyone who enters the home, EI, work person, or landlord can be very triggering for survivors. Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's funny, I have a real short, quick little story to that, to what you're saying here, Father Child. And I remember years ago, this was before I came to the house. I remember I had my own apartment, and I had a roommate at the time. I'm going to make this real short and sweet. Anyway, he was using an electric heater because I had the top half of the house and he had the bottom half. And he was in the basement. So he was using an electric heater. Well, that got to be a little bit rich on the power. So what happened was the landlord's son comes by and makes himself available in the house without asking permission. And in Ontario, under the Landlord Tenant Act, this is within the time period I'm even talking about as well, by law, you are supposed to give your tenant 24 hours notice before entering your premise. Well, that never happened. So back to what I'm saying, what I did was the individual I'm talking about, my landlord's son, come into the house, and I saw him leaving. And it left me with three thoughts that I had in my head. One, do I go out and have a physical altercation with him? Number two, do I call the police and have him charged with trespassing? Or number three, which was the choice that I chose, and that was to give him, well, a mouthful. And that's exactly what I did. I threatened him, and I told him, okay, well, you know what? You went in there, you did that, but you have to give us 24 hours notice. So therefore, I have every right within my limits of the law to call the police and have you charged with trespassing. So I threw that at him as well. So I was really a really nasty, nasty person when I saw that happen. So, you know, to trust people, again, that's another great reason why I wanted to trust anybody. But I let this person have it. You know, he was probably 20 years my senior and probably twice my size, but it made no difference to me whatsoever. I chose to give him an earful. And furthermore, you know, if there was a problem, all they had to do was call and ask, as far as that's concerned. Whether the individual denied it or not, one way or another, I mean, they're going to know anyway. They can tell. But anyway, that was my experience with that. Well, okay, the very first stage. And this is what I went through very, very much so, and that is denial. It is not unusual for people to be trapped in this stage for many years after a physical nature of abuse has ended. There are many good, valid reasons why denial exists and persists. Resurfacing ghosts from the past is not easy to deal with. Even thought the mind suppressed of these memories for good reason, there is a cost involved with keeping unresolved issues away from a conscientious awareness. Denial, whether it is a conscientious or subconscious, takes up a lot of emotional energy. Men and women talk about suffering or burying their feelings through the overuse of alcohol, chemical substances, prescribed medications, and other addictions. These men and women are concerned about their inability to trust anybody, including themselves. Control can be a key concern for many men and women. They often find themselves in one or two extremes. Either they feel totally controlled by others, or they try to control themselves by everything else around them. Having a positive connection with themselves and others seems unattainable for many sexual abuse survivors, men and women, due to the lack of educational material and healthy programs available for male and female survivors. Many men and women choose secrecy and isolation until life becomes unmanageable. Others stay in denial for forever, choosing to live with the associated costs involved with keeping the ghosts from the past in the closet. There is a big difference between privacy and denial. When someone is in denial, they are not attending the concerns of the affecting their quality of life. However, everyone has a right to privacy and the choice of how they work through the issues in their lives. The single biggest concern for survivors is the ability to connect with themselves and others. By staying in denial and creating a false self, there's a limit of healthy connection they so desperately desire. When men and women step out of that denial and start to acknowledge how childhood sexual abuse has had an impact on their adult lives, you know, they enter stage two. Bear with me for a second here. A little sippy here. Really appreciate your comments tonight, Flower Child. All boundary violations are upsetting and triggering for those survivors, even the little ones who like roommates using their shampoo. Absolutely. Stage number two, confused awareness. This is the point where men and women start to take an honest look at their lives for years. They have tried to forget all the uncomfortable memories without success. Many men and women are jolted into disclosure for various reasons. Why men and women are emotionally overloaded with feelings connected to their present event. And it becomes harder to keep feelings connected to the past at bay. It is not easy to face the past. But most people start this stage when overloaded with their own with other concerns. And especially when seeing the connection between the pain of from the past and the hurt from the present. Perhaps a marriage has failed, or they're having difficulty relating to others. Maybe the perpetrator has passed away and they feel it is safer to speak. Addictions may be destroying the connections with the people or things they love. This is a new awareness that puts them into shock as they experience anxiety, panic, and fear. When beginning to deal with unwanted memories, people become confused, doubting their own perceptions. There are a lot of inner negotiations going on at this stage. And some men and women wish they could just forget and move on. But once the cat is out of the bag, it's so much harder to stuff that back in. When people are emotionally overwhelmed, they either engage more heavily in old habits or make a decision to heal. Decision to heal brings men and women to the next stage. And stage number three is reaching out. Coming out of the fog is not easy when you are unsure what is going on the other side. At this stage, men and women understand that the abuse happened, but they also struggle with their inner shame and embarrassment of finding someone safe and supportive to tell their stories to is not an easy task. Like me finding the gatehouse, it was not easy to find. If people are fortunate enough to connect with someone supportive, a decrease of guilt and shame will result. Unfortunately, many men and women seek to get advice from someone who minimizes their pain and promotes an approach that puts men and women back into denial. One common damaging statement victims hear is, "That happened a long time ago, so just forget about it." If it were that easy, they would have. Besides, they already have tried that approach and it did not work. Reaching out and telling their stories helps men and women define their core issues, along with identifying losses. Excuse me. Once men and women step out of their cocoon and begin sorting through their feelings and emotions connected to the past, they often enter the next stage, which is defining, well, in this case, I'm going to read masculinity, but it's the same idea for femininity as well. It's about finding your identity, whether you're male or female. So I'm not being gender specific here, but it's just that it's here in front of me. Most men would like to agree from a purely intellectual perspective, but healing emotional wounds from the past means feelings must be processed and included. How men view masculinity will either hinder or enhance their journey. There are many myths surrounding being a man that are simply obstacles in recovery path, and I would say that for women as well. If people feel that real men are not victims, then they often view themselves as not being real men. This stage gives men an opportunity to become real. It allows men to become persons of who is free to explore a wide range of feelings and emotions, like vulnerability, and reaching out for help can be viewed as masculine, as a strength and not a weakness. And that goes for women as well. Often this is when men start to realize that the abusive situation was not their fault and they step into next stage at full speed. And that is anger, as I've talked about in the beginning of the program. This is a stage explosive feelings, and it creates anger, rage, and desire for justice. Disclosure and confrontation seem to be preoccupied, by the thought process. Reaching out this stage is a reason for celebration. But watch out for fireworks. Group members often talk of intense, highly charged energy that can spark rage and vengeful thoughts. And yes, anger, you know, I know it affects everybody differently. Obviously it does. And how we act obviously is going to be different than everybody else. But I know that when you haven't explored these dark, dark, painful, you know, secrets from the past, and when you first bring them up, like even what I was talking about, and even anger, that wasn't even anger I was talking about, but when I felt like getting teary-eyed because I was talking about my living conditions and the shame that fell over me at that time. I'm only talking about anger now, so I can imagine. Anger is emotional that is essential for the healing process. People often confuse anger with behavior, particularly with people respond with anger with violence. It is not anger that determines the healthiness of one's choices. It is the behavior of or how one responds to the anger that determines if anger works for or against a person. Once someone works through their anger, they will enter the next challenging stage where nobody wants to go there, but is an integral part of the growth progress. A little bit more on the anger, you know. I know even for myself, a lot of what I've done for myself, and I'm talking about self-sabotage, was anger-driven. I know I could say that to myself, say that for myself quite easily. And now, especially now that I realize it at a much greater level than I ever thought possible. So number six, depression. When men and women speak out, they're in the process of intense growth. For this new growth to happen, they often give up portions of their old self. Behaviors that have worked for them as children may hinder their quality of life as an adult. The coping skills that were once useful may be outdated and counterproductive. Old patterns are not always healthy, but are familiar and natural reaction to giving up old and familiar ways of living is depression. If depression helps people recognize the parts of their lives that need to be adjusting, then they can be healthy components in this process. This stage is a time of transformation and integration that brings all parts of a person together. Throughout this stage, there seems to be a death of the old self and a birth of a newer, healthier self. Although this is an intense period of positive growth and can be filled with feelings of helplessness, guilt, remorse, and despair. This stage includes grieving, a loss that can leave someone feeling great sense of emptiness and sadness. Men and women in this stage often find themselves giving up a need for control. This is an only stage, and it will pave for a better place ahead. The next stage can be an eye opener and will positively change people's lives forever. Again, I can't thank you enough, Flower Child. Okay, many survivors find it difficult to take care and keep good personal objects like glasses, keys, clothing. Yes, absolutely, for sure. Survivors often ruin the damage or lose personal property or property of others without even knowing why. Yeah, I can't say I've had that happen too often to me, but I can relate to the very first comment you made about many survivors find it difficult to take care and keep personal objects like glasses, keys, and clothing. Yeah, I used to lose stuff like that all the time, too, for myself. And I've always considered myself to be one of the least disorganized people that I've ever met. granted, I'm being biased, but because it's towards myself, but nevertheless, that's what I used to think. I'm not saying that I was right. Okay. This is so important that I'm going to read out to you here right now. This is so important in your healing process. This is a stage that is closely linked to the stage of depression. By gaining clarity to feelings and emotions, Men and women are automatically working through their core issues that have plagued them for years. The more people process their feelings and the more they step out of depression, this is a wonderful, struggling, confusing, and insightful stage that helps many men and women come to contact with the hurt inner child they left behind. Grieving losses from the past helps facilitate learning that will help people grieve present day losses as they occur. Many women, men and women have not learned to acknowledge or identify the wide range of feelings and emotions that all were experienced. This growing period usually requires help from someone outside their present environment, possibly an individual counseling or support group like the Gatehouse. Clarifying feelings and emotions is an integral part of the healing process, but it is especially useful when stepping out of depression and into the next stage. And the next stage is regrouping. I thought all stages are important. This is a phase that entails a lot of hope. Regrouping is a transforming stage where people start learning to trust appropriately, and most importantly, they learn to trust themselves. They are developing skills to assist them in getting their needs met in a healthy fashion. By taking responsibility for their lives, they feel empowered with enhanced feelings of self-worth. People have worked very hard to get this point and are starting to like the new person that they have become. They are learning to find their own voice, the voice that is able to speak the truth. In previous stages, the group members would characterize themselves as an existing and not living, as I talked about before I came here, minute by minute, day by day, week by week, month by month. Many victims do not plan a future because they never thought there would be one, as I talked about in the beginning. Others expected to die young. Regrouping includes re-putting joy into their journeys. Redefining friendship leads to empowering intimacy and love. Loneliness is converted into enjoying their own company and being comfortable with themselves. Not an easy feat, but it is possible. This great stage opens a person up for a new world full of opportunity. The next stage is a process that many people hesitate to talk about. But from my experience, when some people reach this point, this recovery seems to take off at a speed that can only be called miraculous. Flower Child, making a comfortable, functioning home for yourself is a major part of learning to live life and not just survive it. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And granted, even where I'm living right now, I live in a really, really good home. I have a nice property and all that sort of stuff. And I'm really, really grateful to have that. You know, I talk about isolation and dissociation. You know, that's a great for me to go and do that if I choose to do so. Or if rather, I want to shut the world off. It's fantastic. And I still have that by having a place. But it's a great place to go and regroup is my point. And also, to the point of what Flower Child is making, and that was making a comfortable, functioning home for yourself is a major part of learning to live life and not just survive it. And you're absolutely right. Also, all stages are important. This is a phase that entails a lot of hope. Regrouping is a transforming stage where people start learning to trust appropriately. And most importantly, they learn to trust themselves. You know what? I'm just repeating myself here. I just realized I just did this, so forgive me. The next stage where I should have went was stage number 9, and I'm talking about spirituality. And this is very, very important, as I stated at the end of my last paragraph that I just read to you. As many people grow and mature through the stages, they get a sense of power within themselves that is also greater than themselves. Some group members, which I've heard them say it is like describing the undesirable. A sense of inner peace is connected to what can be viewed as true reality. They talk about emptiness lifting, and they feel that they will never feel alone again. The spiritual connection is often viewed as unconditional love and acceptance. Some men and women have concerns that others are more advanced in their spiritual beliefs than they are. When people are spiritual, and at any given time, is exactly where they should be. Spirituality is an individual experiential journey that develops over time. It is a process, and as people work through their recovery, the views on spirituality often change. A person does not have to be spiritual to heal. groups are based on principle that people have the right to establish their own spirituality and beliefs, and that's what we do. We at the Gatehouse, what we do, definitely, one of the very first things we talk about in the very first week in the phase one program would be men or the women program, and we one thing we encourage right from the beginning is to have some kind of spiritual path. It doesn't matter what you believe in, just have something that feels good for you, as I described it. If you feel, for myself, well, I'm a spiritual person, but I'm certainly not a church-going person, so anything I've done has been outside the church, but it still doesn't mean that I can't be spiritual and I can't be thinking of the greater power, and that's exactly what I did. But I didn't go to church for that. I did that on my own, and I found a greater power that way. Men and women often talk about the healing powers of forgiveness at this stage. People who do not have to forgive their abuser in order to heal, but it's important to forgive yourself, which I struggled for many, many, many years. And even to this day, I've been very open about this, about forgiving myself. And again, like in the statement that I just read, we're not talking about your abuser. We're talking about forgiving yourself. And one of the biggest struggles I had, again, like I say, nothing from my abusers, but forgiving myself for the things that I've done towards myself and others. And I had a very hard time with forgiving myself at any level. And even today, I still have to remind myself and keep myself in check that, I would say that I have forgiven myself to quite a degree. And I won't say completely, because sometimes I fall back on that and then I basically get into that stuck mode of something negative from the past. But I always crawl back out of the hole. It's the same within saying that at the same time. So spirituality is so, so, so important. And I know that I can think of many nights when I was by myself, even days when I was by myself, when I had no one to talk to but myself. And then I would talk to the greater power, because I was, I was lost, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do, didn't know what to say, didn't know how to act. I didn't, all those things were, I was lost. But the spirituality, once I started meditating and doing different things to help myself, then a lot of these things started to change. But that spiritual, that spiritual presence I'm talking about was so very, very important. Knowing I'm isolating myself, but at least I know I can talk to somebody of a greater power. And that helped me immensely. Okay. And finally, last but not least, the very last stage, stage number 10, moving on. This stage includes the rest of their lives. It would be unfair to think people become home free and will never feel vulnerable again. In fact, many men and women go back and refine some of the stages at this time in their lives. How someone views their abuse experience changes from a subjective experience to an objective experience. The thought process becomes more objective to the subjective. They have memories that exist independently and painful feelings and emotions. This stage is a much more comfortable place, which includes deep and lasting changes with a sense of stability. If people seek help to improve their connection with themselves, others, and the world they live in, then moving on must include maintaining a continuous, or rather, maintaining the connections they desire. Okay, so I hope you got what I was getting at and what I'm trying to come across. You know, I having that sense of belonging is probably, you know, I won't say it's been my biggest battle, but it's been one of my biggest battles. And even to this day, I have to struggle and tell myself, you know, I have days where I just want to say, you know, to hell with the world and just pack my bag and be gone and not really be anywhere. And yes, that may seem strange to others, but that's the process, or rather, that's the thoughts that are in my head. And here's another thing that maybe you can relate to as well. And one of the things that I've always done, and even to this day, I still do. I always have a bag packed. Seriously, I do. I have a bag packed. I'm living very much a minimalist. So I have basically not much of anything, and I have been on the fence, knowing that I'm not going to be there long. So therefore, my bag is always packed, ready to go. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I can't imagine being a good thing, because it would be nice just to stay in one place forever, but it don't work that way. But I always have a bag packed. And that's something else I know we've talked about this quite frequently. How about that? Well, if you don't feel... you don't feel you belong, you don't trust anybody, then that's totally, I guess that would be totally, totally normal. But, you know, I've been in the place that I've been now for 3 years now, and I'm telling you, it's a hell of a lot better than living out of my vehicle or living on the streets. And I have no desire to go back and do that whatsoever, no matter how angry I am. If I've learned anything out of all these experiences that I've encountered and lived, then, well, that's going to be one of them right there. It was where I'm not going to go and, you know, sleep in my vehicle through the winter, for example, or the hot summer, which I've done, you know. I had more than a couple winters like that. And it's certainly not a way to live. And I really wouldn't encourage it on anybody. And it all falls back to what I was believing, what I was thinking, you know. The bottom line at the end of the day is I didn't have to do all that, but I did. And I don't expect many people to understand or to approve or disapprove, even though it's really nothing to do with them, but nevertheless, or to even have some kind of empathy for somebody to understand to why I did that, and knowing that I didn't have to, but yet I did. So I think we shall leave this here for tonight. And there's probably one point I should probably make before I, you know, unwind this down here. And that is that I can actually say, you know, almost daily I have little signs of something telling me that I belong here. So I can fight this to the end, and I probably will, knowing me being the stubborn, you know, jackass that I can be sometimes. I can, I will probably fight that too, but the thing is, the funny thing is, every time I fight it, I end up losing it. So I may fight and try to, you know, sabotage it, but I can't deny it. And I guess that's really the big thing that I really need to say, is that I can't deny that I have a sense of belonging, profound and twisted as it may be in my head. It doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that, you know, yes, I don't feel I belong, but really deep down I do. I know I have a place to live. I have people that care about me. You know, I may have days where I think that I don't have that, and it's outright BS, but I have days that's like that. So for me to fall back in that path again, I think it would, I couldn't imagine going back that way. I mean, I'd really be going backwards in regards to my recovery. So, folks, if you're out there and you have, someone to talk to, then I really recommend that you would hopefully, that person has that kind of empathy that you can talk about this stuff to, or somebody anyway. Folks, it's been a really, really good night. I talked about something that's been very, well, it's been rotting my gut for so long, and thank you, Flower Child, for actually bringing this up, because I thought about talking about this again at a much deeper level like I did tonight a while ago, but I just haven't taken it upon myself to do it. And when you passed this suggestion along to me, it sort of struck a chord with me, whether it did, and I had to follow through with it. Feeling I belong or not feeling I belong? What am I going to do? What am I going to decide? What am I going to feel? Where am I going to go? I'm just tired of those thoughts. I'm so tired of those thoughts. I've been struggling with those thoughts all my life, and now I just want to, you know, I want to put that thought on a couch someplace, because I really don't want to think about that anymore. Because in reality, it has worn me out in ways that I can't even describe. So therefore, with saying what I've said this evening at all levels, it only leaves me one choice, and that is to keep moving forward. I still have bad days where I want to fall backwards and run, but I don't. I stay here and I keep talking about this. I keep fighting, trying to change my false beliefs, you know, and to believe that, yeah, it's a false belief, but to believe the truth is what I'm getting at. Flower Child, you have to feel like you belong in your own body in order to feel the sense of belonging with people and places. Yeah, that's really well said. And it's funny you talk about that, because I've never liked my body in any way or fashion. You know, I always thought that I was very disgusting because of my past. And that sort of went along with that as well. But the only trouble with that is that it affects your health. If you think you're nothing but a piece of crap, then you're going to eat like that. And therefore your body is not going to protect itself from, you know, colds and diseases very, very well, because you're not looking after yourself very well. And a lot of other things could come along and complicate that as well, like health complications. You know, so before you isolate yourself and shut the world off, you know, if you could just find that person to talk to, that would be, you know, that would change everything. You know, I was fortunate enough to find a gatehouse. Not many people have that luxury like I have had. And I'm going to be grateful pretty much right to the end, whenever that may be. And I love the fact that I can come in here and I could talk about this stuff and not have to worry about being shamed. You know, it's all positive. And I'm going to choose staying on this path. And I'm hoping that you who listen to me here tonight, or whenever you might listen to me, you'll understand that things can change. I've changed things for myself. Releasing the psychic shock from your body will allow you to bond to your body for the first time. Again, I remember you were talking about that one time, Flower Child, and how wonderful that was. That's why I think I would like to get that. As I mentioned even in the last week's show, that I would like to get Deb Adams back again, because she's a biofeedback specialist, and I'd love her to do a reading on me to find out what's going on, because I'd love to get rid of that physical pain you're talking about completely. So thank you for pointing that out. Okay, so folks, I think I'm going to call it tonight. I'm going to just mention this one more time before I sign off. I'm going to talk about, which I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Healing Within the Voice Within, art exhibit and fundraiser, the Gatehouse 2nd Annual, be October 25th at 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. down at the Spoke Club at 600 King Street West in Toronto, in the Portland Room. And if you would like to attend, please go onto our website and you'll see a link there, or call the Gatehouse at 416-255-5900 or you can go onto our website at www.thegatehouse.org. And if you have any comments or anything in regards to what I talked about tonight, go on to personaltransformation.ca and leave a comment there if you'd like to do that. It's quite open for that. I have a posting I need to do, which I'm going to have to put up there, which I probably won't get up until Monday, but I will have a posting and relating to what my topic was about tonight and how it relates to my last week's topic. So I encourage you to get on there and take a look-see at the same time, and you can see what this blog post is all about. And I have it posted on the personal, on the Blog Talk Radio site, and I've also got it on my Twitter page on Twitter as well. And yes, thank you, Flower Child, and thank you for the suggestion. And yeah, it was a little bit of a tough one there talking about this stuff tonight, but I think it was time and necessary to get it off my chest, another way of getting out of stuckness and that experience to moving forward. So I think that was very beneficial on my part to even talk about it as well. So hopefully you out there got something out of it as well. And more importantly, if I've triggered you in any way whatsoever by listening to this, please, if you're Canada or U.S., call RAIN, or you can go on their website at rain.org. They have a chat line on there as well. You can go on there anonymously. They don't even have to know your name. Or you can call them at 1-800-656-4674 or 1-800-656-HOPE. And if you're in the Greater Toronto Area, Downtown Toronto, Gerstein Center, 416-929-5200. If you are in the West End, Peel, 905-278-9036. If you are Downtown Toronto, 416-408-4357. And that is a 24-hour hotline, by the way, as well. And again, thank you, Flower Child, for all your comments. We greatly appreciate it. Folks, have a great week. I'm going to tell you right now that with my work schedule being the way it is, I will not be here next week, as I do have to do. Unfortunately, working in IT is where I do. I have to do, unfortunately, I have to do a cutover, and unfortunately, it's going to cut into my radio show time. So, and that kind of pays my bills, so I kind of got to go. So, folks, I will not be here next week unless something strangely happens, and then I will be here. But other than that, you'll see me within 2 weeks, and that will be on the, let me just get my calendar here in front of me. Actually, it's right here. What am I doing? Where is it? There you are. Okay, yes, I will see you on September 28th. And have a great week. Have a great weekend ahead. And those that are listening from Twitter, tomorrow is Purple Friday. So if you go on Twitter and you hashtag Purple Friday, hashtag Twitter, then and then also throw in the hashtag CSA Survivors, then this thing we wanted to, what we're trying to do, what they're trying to do is they want us to go mainstream. And that's what they're trying to do. And so we're looking for people to go on there on Friday, to go on Twitter, and you tweet hashtag Purple Friday, hashtag Twitter. And actually, if you go on to, on the Twitter, and I'll just get the exact information here right now. Just let me get on here. Oh, come on. This. Yes. Now, the person that started this, I should be, now I've got the information in front of me. So I let me pay homage to a I admire this man immensely, and a very, very strong ambassador. And what he's doing, he's empowering voices from CSA survivors. So basically, David Lean is his name. So if you go to Twitter and you go in and you search for David Lean, David Lean is an ex-footballer from Preston, and being obviously in England, not here in Canada, but he is from the UK. And what he is doing right now, he's a football survivor, and of CSA as well, he battles as well. But right now, if you go on there, and you will see that if you go, he's got a part page, rather, he's got it pinned on his page, and he's talking about Purple Friday. And what it's about is it's about raising awareness, and I guess you can call it fellowship as well, for other CSA survivors to come forward. I know in the UK, this is really, really big right now. This is a big conversation. And I know that their political system is a whole lot different than ours, is, although they're very similar. And everything is different. But anyway, my point being is that David Lean is the one that orchestrated Purple Friday. So I encourage you tomorrow to go on Twitter and hashtag Purple Friday, Twitter, and hashtag CSA survivors all day tomorrow. So folks, please go out there and do that and support the cause. Thank you very much. Have a great night, what's left of it. Good evening, good weekend ahead. And we'll talk to you on the 28th. Have a good night. Thank you for your time.